Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. And welcome to another episode of the New Books Network, Russian and Eurasian Studies. I am your host, Polina Popova, and today I'm interviewing Erica Fraser, a historian and a scholar of the Soviet Union, about her 2019 book, Military Masculinity and Postwar Recovery in the Soviet Union, which was published at the University of Toronto Press. Hello, Erica, and welcome.
Hello, Polina. Thank you.
Erica, I just wanted to ask you, before we get into all of the questions I prepared for you, I wanted to ask you about your background, and can you just talk about yourself and introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. And, you know, thanks so much for having me on. My name is Erica Fraser, and I'm an associate professor in the history department at Carleton University in Ottawa, Ontario, up in Canada. I'm a historian of gender and culture in the Soviet Union, especially the 1930s to the 1960s or so, although I might be reaching a bit earlier than that in my new work we can talk about later. But I'm interested in women's and gender history, you know, masculinities, obviously, and sort of how big institutions like the military intersected with culture. I am from Canada. I did my PhD at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and then came back up to Canada to work and teach after much time in the U.S. So I sort of have the cross-border experience, and I teach widely in East Slavic and Imperial Russian history, so Soviet history, Cold War, gender history. And I'm moving into sports history a little bit.
Oh, wow. That is very interesting. Then my first question will be about the actual topic of the book. Why Soviet masculinity? Why did you decide to pursue that topic? In general, I know you're interested in gender, but why precisely Soviet masculinity? How did you become interested in this and in regards to, you know, Soviet masculinity and military history? And I'm just, from the get-go, when I was reading your book and that little anecdote that with the cheesy joke cracked by Nidzielin right in the beginning, and I thought of it, and I wanted to ask you, did pacifism in the Soviet context mean, you know, what it means, and does it, how is it related to sexuality and sort of like gender issue and masculinity and male issue? Can you elaborate on all of that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, why Soviet masculinity? The off-color joke, I'm going to have to tell the joke in a minute that opens the book. But I mean, I kind of got in on the ground floor of masculinity's history in the 1990s. Here, I'll date myself as a graduate student at the University of British Columbia in the 90s. And I was sort of interested in women's and gender history, interested in Russian and Soviet history, and sort of looking for a way to put those fields together. And, many historians of gender will know the history of masculinities emerges in, you could debate this, but the 80s and especially into the 90s as historians basically try to historicize it. You know, there's a sort of movement at the time in pop culture about men's rights and men's studies that's in many ways saying men have always been a certain way throughout time. And so historians sort of come in and go, that's not true. What does sort of the process of culturally constructing masculinities look like in different time periods, different parts of the world? And so I was sort of taking graduate courses in that, and I found it a really exciting way to do gender history and to do sort of feminist histories as well. I think it works, perfectly in tandem with women's history, with gender history. It's not necessarily a separate thing to look at masculinities. And so by the time I sort of got to my dissertation research in 2005 or so, maybe I shouldn't use real dates, but that research in many years later and many more research trips later became this book. But I was interested in how I might apply what I saw as this really fascinating and innovative gender history. You know, I've been reading in British history, in American, French, South African history, many parts of the world. I thought, how might I apply it to the Soviet Union and, other scholars at that time, the early 2000s in Imperial Russian and Soviet history were also asking those kinds of questions. And for me, the particular backdrop of socialism in the USSR, I thought, how might that change the questions that I was reading sort of in theory and in other fields about historical masculinities? In particular, given the prominent role of women in the Soviet Union and the ideological commitment to women's equality. That's not to say, obviously, as we all know, women's history, women's rights in the Soviet Union were not guaranteed, and that's a really fraught history as well. But the ideological commitment to women's equality, I think, put different pressures on cultural masculinities and sort of how that might develop. And so I wanted, it's something I'm still sort of passionate about, is how can histories of this part of the world help people reading in French history and in histories of other parts of the world on gender, on masculinities? What do we have to offer from Soviet history that other fields might take on masculinities? And so I sort of had those questions in mind. And I was interested in military institutions. You see in Soviet history, even for non-specialists, you see a lot of militarized imagery, right? Some folks in making those assumptions that from outside the fields, that drawing on Cold War tropes, like the Soviet soldier was this sort of robotic, monolithic figure. But I wanted to break down that sort of archetype, that common image, and historians of gender and war have shown that there is no sort of natural link between masculinity and military identity. And that sort of link has to be forged and maintained. And sort of there's a process there. It's not natural. So I wanted to sort of untangle some of those assumptions and ask, what were the cultural links between masculinity and military service? And most importantly, coming out of World War II, which saw so much destruction in the Soviet Union for people's lives, obviously, for the countryside, how was the Soviet Union going to recruit basically young people and young men and teenage boys after a recruiting conscript? Obviously, conscription is still part of Soviet culture. Mm-hmm. So given that destruction, how were they going to sell military service after the destruction of World War II? And so, I sort of took that as a central question and end up looking at how My central argument, you know, is that the service of women in the war, where 500,000 women served, led to a backlash from the late 40s through to the 60s, where a variety of institutional and cultural forces try to reclaim military service as masculine for men and to exclude women. Mm-hmm. And we can, I'll stop there for a second, but we can get into Nadjelin and sexualization as well.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to add to what you said about the militarized images. I deal with the 1930s children's literature, and it's very, especially towards the end of the 30s, it's very masculinized and very militarized. So basically 80% of the books are either related to military history or are directly about military history, great military heroes of the past. So it has always been there in the Soviet context, and especially in the pre-war period. And I imagine it's sort of somehow changed in the post-World War II world, but also didn't. And going back to that anecdote, that cheesy Nedelin episode, for those who haven't read the book yet, we can talk about it. I wanted to ask you, so you argue in general that the Soviet post-World War II masculinity wasn't actually in crisis, right? Can you elaborate on that? Or maybe I misunderstood you and maybe there was some sort of a crisis. Can you please elaborate?
Yeah, for sure. Well, and it's so interesting on the 20s and 30s as well. And I'd say it's not just that this sort of masculinization of military service and military imagery, and not necessarily that it's always been there, but that it comes and goes in waves. And, there's other scholars have worked on the Civil War, and women's service in the Civil War also led to this sort of backlash in the 20s as the Bolsheviks are sort of establishing power and sort of getting rid of women in service at that time too. So there's this cycle in the 20s and early 30s of remasculinizing. And that's so interesting that you see that in your work as well. And then we see women in service as a sort of emergency measure in the 40s and another sort of wave, I would argue, of backlash where you get rid of women and femininity in military spaces and sort of remasculinize it. And that this is sort of a process. We have to tell the joke now, and then I do want to talk about a crisis, but now listeners are wondering about, it's very lewd, and so warning for lewdness, and I'll try to keep my language clear, but it's such a revealing thing. So it's an anecdote I read in the memoirs of Andrei Sakharov, the famous eventually pacifist physicist who wrote his memoirs much later. And became famous in the West for his pacifism and activism against nuclear proliferation. But in the 40s and 50s, he was a key figure working on the hydrogen bomb. And so one of my chapters discusses him and some major figures in physics. But I open the book with this story he tells in his memoirs, where he's at a banquet in 1955 after the successful test of the hydrogen bomb. And he says he got up to give a toast and says, "May all our devices explode as successfully as today's, but always over test sites and never over cities." And then he says the host of the evening, Marshal Nedelin, a hero of the Soviet Union for his war service, he was a huge figure in the military, he gets up and raises his own glass, and here's the lewd joke. He says, "Let me tell a parable. An old man was wearing only a shirt and praying before an icon. 'Guide me, harden me, guide me, harden me,' he says. His wife, who's lying on the stove, said, 'Just pray to be hard, old man. I can guide it in myself.'" Then Nedelin says, in Sakharov's narration of it, "Let's drink to getting hard." And all of this is from Sakharov's point of view in his memoirs, written many years later. So, like, it's not that it didn't happen, and it's been corroborated, by other historians of science and the military, this sort of off-color joke. But I found it really revealing, and it ends up sort of anchoring the themes of the book overall, in that Sakharov wants to make this anecdote appear as though, you know, he's this pacifist civilian scientist who'd not served in the war, and he's chastised by this hard power of this decorated senior military guy. But elsewhere in his memoir and the other physicist memoirs I looked at, they present their masculinity in sort of shifting ways. As they too were hard or hegemonic and godlike in what they could create and destroy, they have these different presentations of themselves. So I sort of look at this presentation he gives of soft versus hard masculinity for military masculinity, but that's only part of the story. There's much more of a spectrum there, much more of a sort of network.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's also just, I read that anecdote like very early in my research, and it sort of stayed on page one for a decade. And I thought I have to put that in there. It's just such a incredible story.
No, it is perfect, because I think what anecdote reveals on a, I mean, for scholars, right, putting jokes aside, is that pacifism, right, and this kind of liberalism for many military men meant sort of cultural and political impotence, right? So like speaking in sexualized terms, right? But political impotence or like whatever. So it's just interesting how it was interpreted by this marshal or Nedelin, this military.
Yeah, for sure. And the sort of like that chapter I called Telling Manly Stories About Nuclear Physics, because it's in the memoir literature, it's in the storytelling, how this is sort of narrated. And the pacifism, you know, a guy like Sakharov finds later in life is sort of written back in as, oh, I was powerless in the face of this powerful marshal. And I think it's much more complex than that in a way.
Interesting. Your book is an excellent example of a very effective use of the illustrations. You have a lot of caricature. I don't know if the English term would be cartoons, comics, or caricatures, but it's sort of, for the listeners, it's sort of similar to the New Yorker cartoons, right? From the Crocodile Journal, from the Soviet journal, and it's one of your central sources. I noticed that you also mention the Komsomol archives. And I'm just, first of all, I wanted to say how I enjoyed reading the book, and part of that enjoyment was looking through all the illustration, as naive as it can sound. I love when books have a lot of illustrations. But I also am curious, as a scholar, if you can talk about your primary sources for this study and the archival work you did, and how you got the permission to use all of these images. I'm just super curious about this.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And thank you. I'm glad it sort of resonated. And I mean, it was fascinating and also just a lot of fun to look through Crocodile cartoons and or caricatures, the sort of political cartoons for listeners. This is a satirical, very, very major satirical magazine that was published almost throughout the Soviet Union. Just about the whole run of it. It just means the crocodile. And it was this really interesting publication. A lot of historians, you know, use it in various ways. It was sort of famous for historians in making taboo topics come to life. And despite being a state publication and subject to censorship, it was also somewhere where Soviet authorities sort of tacitly allowed, within reason at certain times, allowed things to be talked about. And so I sort of went through it to see if I could find some talk of the sort of cultural building and rebuilding of masculinities, because, you know, as gender and cultural historians know, that sort of evidence isn't always just, you know, in an archive, in a file somewhere where it's going to say, what did people think about masculinities? You know, we have to sort of be creative with sources. And so I have, yeah, this sort of cartoon base, other cultural sources like some literature, some film, some songs, some newspapers, some memoirs, and various things like that. I did do some archival work as well in Moscow some time ago when it was still okay to go there. I know many students now can't, unfortunately, from North America, but I worked in the Komsomol archive. I mean, I had to get around, even for archives, I had to get around not being able to get into military archives. So the Komsomol, the Communist Youth League archives, had documents about conscription and for young people and pre-conscription training, which was really useful and sort of a roundabout way of getting at that. Famous GARF, the main archive of the Russian Federation, has some records about civilian defense organizations that were involved in essentially in high schools in preparing young people for service, and had some records of these officer academies that I look at. But essentially, like, I got back from archival research the first time and had maybe half a chapter worth of material. So, you know, I had always planned to use other types of sources, but that really helped me solidify, you know, my positioning as a cultural historian going, you know, I'm not finding the answers here. I had some sort of facts and you know, I could sort of see how these institutions were run. How did conscription work? What were authorities worried about? But it only got me so far and the questions I was asking. And so, you know, cultural history is its own sort of approach and its own methodology of like seeing meaning and finding meaning in literature, in film, in cartoons, in visuals, in places where, you know, interpretation might be required, but taken together, I found that this evidence was quite powerful in showing over and over again in different ways and different sites that I visit in these chapters of how the, you know, authorities and young men and women alike are trying to sort of reclaim the Soviet military for men and exclude women in a variety of ways using this variety of sources.
Very interesting. And I should say, should add a little bit that I also love cultural history for this exact reason, because it juxtaposes so greatly with literary studies and art history, right? So we can work with all kind of sources. This is amazing.
Yeah. I skipped over your crisis question. I can always go back to that.
Go ahead.
I don't want to talk too much, but I'm like, oh gosh.
No, go ahead. It's very interesting.
It's such a good question. I mean, I don't want to skip it because it is a really important question, and it's part of, you know, ongoing debates in gender history and histories of masculinities. I have these spirited debates with colleagues of ours, you know, all the time who have a different argument about it than me. I do say and argue in the introduction that this, I sort of argue against crisis, mostly because the evidence just didn't take me there, you know, and I know other folks working in the later 60s and 70s when, especially in newspapers in the Soviet Union and various other sites, they're using that language. They're, you know, the primary sources are saying masculinity is in crisis. And so I think that it's a matter of following the evidence in many respects. And my evidence, even this sort of array of evidence I put together, it wasn't using terminology like that, not in the archives, not in the cultural sources I was looking at. It wasn't using that sort of language. So in one sense, I didn't want to sort of assign a framework there that I wasn't seeing in the sources. And even when it is in the sources, I think the historian has to be a bit cautious about believing, you know, a source saying this is a crisis. Is it though? Or what is leading that source to say it that way? But the other, you know, reasons are a bit more theoretical. And there's the great gender historian of France, Mary Louise Roberts, started writing about this 10 years ago or so. And that's been really influential on me and other historians who are you know, we're starting to say it was sort of a common way to frame histories of masculinities in the early 2000s. Like it must always be in crisis, especially after moments of war, revolution, disruption in gender roles in some way. And Roberts and others started to say, yeah, but does this term mean anything anymore? Is it always in crisis? And what do we mean by that? And is there another way to frame it? And she landed on gender damage in her work, which is really interesting. For me, I found it more of a sort of process rather than moment of crisis, that the sort of process of recalibrating military masculinity, reclaiming military spaces for men, as I argue, wasn't a one point thing that was going to solve a crisis, but rather it sort of happened slowly throughout the 40s and into the 60s. In my evidence, and it's much more dynamic than just trying to sort of solve a single problem. So I mean, others, you know, can use it, and as I say, depending on the evidence, I think it can be still useful. But I think historians should ask questions about it. Is it just sort of falling into a framework that others have used, or does it really match the processes and evidence that we're seeing?
I see. Now I want to get to Khrushchev, if you don't mind. And you also mentioned Stalin and his post 1948 remilitarization and the idea of like masculinity in that time. But I actually want to talk more about Khrushchev when he came to power. You're right that he reduced military troops. So I wonder, was it solely due to the general policy of de-Stalinization? Did he want to sort of juxtapose himself to the post-1948 Stalin? Or was there another reason for that? And can you talk just in general about this manhood after 1957? And you already touched upon it, so you don't have to say anything else if you don't want to, but just in general, what was the, you know, manhood about after 1957 in the Khrushchev era?
Yeah, it's interesting with the general sort of periodizations that Soviet historians tend to use, and which, you know, in recent works have been disrupting more about, you know, 1953 with Stalin's death and what policies or cultural sort of constructions change and what doesn't change. And I find sort of a mixed bag on that. Conscription is sort of more openly discussed, I found, after Stalin's death, definitely, than it was before. But some things are not necessarily changing. Physicists in that chapter report feeling just as surveilled under Khrushchev as Stalin, for instance. But the major difference for the Khrushchev era is, as you say, his troop reductions. And he's in general more in favor of like a future of rocket forces versus ground troops. And so he makes some adjustments to conscription terms and to the overall numbers of basically, you know, rank and file sort of forces. And that causes more hand-wringing, more anxiety, you know, within the leadership of the Komsomol and the Ministry of Defense that I looked at, who are very worried that young teenage guys are not going to know how to be men if they aren't in the military, basically. So you know, some anxieties that had been there since the late 40s and sort of simmering in various places and various sites of meaning, they really crystallize under Khrushchev and this sort of sense of, you know, young men won't know how to be a proper Soviet man, whatever that might mean, if they're not doing military service. And so the troop reductions socially and culturally sort of have these effects, if not on the ground. And like young men themselves are like not interested. This is the other thing, you know, I found is not just looking at the institutional records or what policymakers wanted, but what were men in, how are they interpreting these sort of directives or this idea of like, you must be interested in the military, even though it's not a time of war, and you just watched your older brothers and fathers die horribly in World War II. This is the generation we're talking about. And for the most part, you know, other historians have talked about the late 50s and 60s as in young people, right? As they're in dance halls, the Stilyagi, they're doing different stuff. They're locating their identities in different ways, different masculinized sites. They're forming their cultural and gender identities in different ways in many respects. And they largely don't care about the military. And this is sort of the message that policymakers are getting too. And this is why they're concerned. But yeah, you know, especially after 57, and this sort of launched me into the final chapter on the cosmonauts, which I see in the early 60s as a sort of culmination of by the early 60s, after all this hand-wringing in the 50s about how will young guys get masculine enough if they don't care about military imagery and service? Mm-hmm. Yuri Gagarin comes along, right? And so I argue that's on purpose. And he's always presented in his Air Force uniform. And he is an image of a militarized guy. Of course, they're not saying, I'm getting excited now, but they're not saying that the cosmonauts are doing military stuff. They don't want to say that in a Cold War context. But why is he always in uniform? You know, there's this sort of imagery and cultural meaning attached here to you know, be creating a hero and not just him, but the cohort that he flies with in the first few years. So yeah, I see that troop production under Khrushchev is a really pivotal moment for, as I say, the hand-wringing, the anxieties about where, how will young men learn about military masculinity? And then that sort of takes it into the cosmonauts' heroism and world tours.
Mm-hmm. In one of the chapters, speaking of this militarization of young men and sort of growing up them, I'm taking this word in quote properly, right, as proper men. One of the chapters in the book is actually about the Suvorov military cadets, the famous Suvorovskoye училище, right? And you also discuss there the idea of круговая порука, and as a person interested in this history of Soviet education and pedagogy, it just caught my mind, and it's a very specific phenomenon. And I was wondering if you can discuss it and also relate it to your general interest and why круговая порука is sort of central for this chapter about Suvorov military cadets.
Yeah, sure. I maybe it's giving an impression that my chapters are sort of all over the place, and they are in a way. I sort of took these five sites in military and military adjacent parts of Soviet society and culture, and they are kind of disparate. But yeah, one chapter is on the Suvorov officer academies, which were formed in 1943 in various cities around the country, essentially to educate boys who had lost fathers in the war. So even by, you know, in 43, there's this concern, like, how will boys be socialized if in this increasingly, what was increasingly a country of women, right? And historians of the post-war era and society have chronicled this, that statistically, there's just far more women in the country by the end of the war, by halfway through the war, as well as by the end of the war. So there's this real concern about educating boys, and scholars of education have found that in civilian education as well, that boys and girls are separate in the 40s in order to make sure boys are sort of getting the right quote-unquote education. But the Suvorov academies sort of make up this makeshift family situation within their walls that excludes women. And so the sort of nurturing roles, the upbringing roles are given to men. In order to, you know, to sort of properly socialize cadets in military masculinity and to sort of exclude women, as I sort of argue throughout. And it's veterans they employ as instructors, as sort of this middling brotherhood between the younger cadets and the older administrators, to be role models, except it doesn't work as planned. And these instructors who, you know, are sort of in their late 20s to 40s, let's say, keep showing up in the records for disciplinary infractions, like not watching the children properly or putting them in danger. There's a horrible incident of drowning in one case because the instructor is drunk and not watching the children, and in all sorts of ways in which they're behaving in ways the defense authorities deem to be very improper as military role models. So there's this whole section there about, like, who will the role models be if these veterans, you know, employed at the Suvorov Academy, since not to say it's all of them, but this is what shows up in the institutional records, at least, they're not the right guys. You know, they're in authorities, again, the hand-wringing. But the cadets, meanwhile, are not behaving properly either, quote unquote. And I found all kinds of sort of internal reports from the school authorities about Krugovaya Paruka, as you say, which, you know, has a few translations depending on the era. It's generally sort of community surveillance. And it's not just a Soviet thing. It's a much older term going back to 17th, 18th century peasant culture, where the village had to come together to ensure everyone contributed to the landlord's taxes, for instance, or to sort of ensure everyone was behaving properly in the mir, the commune. So it's sort of revived in Soviet factories and other sites where communal pressures could ostracize an individual who didn't conform or contribute. So for the Suvorov cadets, the authorities seemed really concerned about how they would band together to protect each other from discipline. If somebody did something wrong, but the school authorities sort of didn't know who, they wouldn't get that answer from the students. And so there's a lot of anxiety in the records about this. So I didn't have a ton of evidence to talk about it in detail, but I found it really important in giving a glimpse of how boys and young men on the ground were responding to the government directives I'm seeing in the archives, right? It sort of hinted at what's going on culturally beyond archival sources, which is, you know, the interesting stuff in history to me. You know, I was probably never going to find memoirs or diaries from these boys confessing, you know, what they're doing behaviorally or why. And only looking at this sort of history from the point of view of the authorities distorts it, of course. But it gave me sort of a glimpse and this concern in the records about Krugovaya Paruka, about the boys are not telling us what happened. The boys are protecting each other. They're forming their own brotherhoods in a way within these schools environment. I found that really telling and had, you know, cultural meaning, even the sort of whispers of it in the archive of, for how these boys might be responding to this directive to take up military masculinity, how whatever that meant to them. And for many of them, it seemed to mean protecting each other, forming brotherhoods, even if their principals, their military authorities are telling them not to do that, you know, to tell on somebody who needs discipline, that they're forming their own circles on the ground. And yeah, I thought that was just a hint of it, but I thought that was really interesting culturally.
Very interesting, Erica. And by the way, I wanted to say, I don't think that your book is all over. I think it's great that you have chapters that sort of reflect on each and every domain of where Soviet masculinity can be seen, can be found, and the representation of it can be traced. And maybe my questions are all over it because I only have a certain amount of time and I want to talk about all aspects of the book. Yeah. So my next question, speaking of like jumping around, and by the way, I wanted to say it's a horrible incident about the drunk instructor. And I think these things still happen in Russia, or should I say in military academies all over the world, because it's a very closed, these are usually very closed institutions, and the abuses of power often tend to happen there. And I also have a comment in regards to your expression country of women, and my parents, who were born in mid-50s, used to tell me how very often, and there's so they would go to school starting from like 1962 when they were seven, and they would tell me how in the 60s there were so many single women who probably lost their, you know, boyfriends or husbands or future or potential husbands to the World War II. In their 40s, 50s, and they were very masculine. They would have tough voices. They would often smoke a lot, dress up sort of manly. And my mom would often tell me how it was sort of sad to look at them, how they sort of had to sort of adjust to that, like you said, country of women, right? A country that lost a lot of men, and they had to perform this sort of masculine roles for their own, and especially in school, I guess you have to gain some sort of authority, and you have to be a little bit authoritative as a man. Again, I'm taking this in quotation marks.
Yeah, and it certainly wasn't easy for many women to live in a society as single women or single mothers in a, you know, society that's sort of built for families or for male breadwinners isn't the right term, but sort of for masculinized power structures. But on the other hand, I'm sure, and I'd love to see more histories of this. Again, it's a question of sources, but how many women found a lot of freedom in that in unmarried life as well, especially, you know, heterosexual women, to say nothing of queer women in Soviet history that we need so much more research on, and is difficult to find, of course. But it's I think there's probably more than we know who quite enjoyed not having to get married and deal with a man at home, so to speak. But yeah, it affects all sorts of you know, historians of post-war society have looked at this, all sorts of angles in society, from reproductive rights legislation has to change, bachelor tax, so-called, and taxation changes, and you know, there's just how to, the country essentially has to support single mothers more than it wants to, because that's just the reality. So it affects, yeah, all sorts of parts of Soviet society, for sure. That's so interesting about your parents too.
No, this is another research to be written by someone, or maybe by you. But you're right, absolutely. I'm sure to an extent, a lot of women actually might have enjoyed or gained some social privileges from that. So jumping to another chapter of yours, I wonder if and I should admit this was my favorite. Can we discuss the Thaw era masculinity in literature and cinema? Can you talk a little bit about it?
I can talk a little bit about it. I think you might know it more thoroughly than me. And I other historians, I don't want to claim it's just on, I surveyed literature and film thoroughly, because other historians have done that far better than me. And so what I did, though, is read a bunch of military fiction that nobody else wasn't popular, and even people at the time didn't want to read, which was kind of fun in its own way. So, yeah, like I have not thoroughly looked at the classics in literature and cinema of the Thaw era in any respect. But what I did was look at some military fiction, especially that was published in this particular magazine for conscripts called Voyennye Znanya, or Military Knowledge. And it's published for pre-conscription youth and conscripts within this sort of civilian defense organization. And they're worried nobody wants to read military fiction either. Young kids these days don't read anything, but they're trying to figure out what kind of stories in a cultural form in literature will young guys be interested in. It's part of sort of this overall project, as I mentioned, of authorities trying to figure out what young men these days, in the, you know, especially in the early 50s, mid 50s, what they want. How can we get them interested in military stuff? They just don't seem to care beyond being forced into, you know, conscription for a couple of years. And even that is for many of them quite benign, at least in between wars. So for a long time, there's this just heroism of the war years. So even in the 50s, these short stories in this magazine are set during the war. And then you can safely write about heroism and try to get guys in the 50s excited about the war heroes. But there's sort of a shift in the mid-50s to finally writing about the mid-50s, about, you know, serving in peacetime and just what are you doing in your barracks to not get bored and become masculine, so to speak. And so I looked at in more detail at a couple of novels that were made into films in the mid 50s, one called Maxim Perepelitsa and one called The Soldier Ivan Brovkin. Neither of them are super popular now, but they were both comedies, which was sort of unusual. You didn't make comedies about military service, but they both come out around 1955. And the gist of both of them is a young guy from a village who's sort of a clown, sort of aimless, pulls practical jokes. He is conscripted into service, although they downplay the conscripted part, right? As if it was voluntary, but okay, he goes into service. It was conscription. And there he becomes a man, you know, is sort of the gist that he learns discipline and he learns not to pull pranks anymore and to make his bed properly and comb his hair and cut his hair. In one of them, he has long hair that is cut to be more proper and this sort of thing. And there's hijinks in the meantime. Both characters get a girl by the end and this sort of thing. So it's set in peacetime for really the first time in the mid-50s. And this sort of vision of service for these newer conscripts that is still about modeling discipline, about being a proper quote unquote man through service. So those were sort of the major literature and film sources I looked at, but they were revealing and sort of as a way at getting at more sort of cultural moments outside of archival evidence that I thought were really interesting for anyone reading or watching that film at the time. What would they have sort of been shown?
Uh-huh. Very interesting. No, I think these films are actually rather popular and.
Yeah, they are a little bit. They're not covered as much in the historiography, shall we say. But at the time, yeah, I think they were popular enough.
Yeah. So now can we shift to the gender issues and masculinity in the Soviet post-war foreign affairs? And you actually, so we are now shifting from like the actual Soviet Union men to the Western capitalist men, right? And the cartoons you brought as the examples often show Western capitalist men as being feminine. Sometimes they're quite literally like cross-dressing as women. Sometimes they are shown as women, and sometimes they are just shown as having some female characteristics on them, and that is where the joke is often coming from. I mean, these are caricatures. So was there a particular reason behind that mocking and feminization of the capitalist manhood of the time?
It's so interesting, and it's a pity in a podcast we can't immediately show listeners this stuff. And so I hope folks will read that part of the book just for the visuals. It just sort of stopped me in my tracks. I was looking through Krokodil, this satirical magazine, and finding a few things here and there, until I got to the late 40s into the 50s. And there's this period in the mid-50s. It's not necessarily post-Stalin, I wouldn't say. It sort of crosses that boundary of Stalin's death. It's there before and after. But it disappears by the 60s. So it's sort of this moment in Krokodil in the 50s where foreign affairs are represented, and early Cold War foreign affairs are represented in tremendously gendered ways. And again, I didn't see it earlier than this, and I don't see it nearly as much after this period in the mid-50s. And I wasn't entirely sure what to do with this, but it, excuse me, it ultimately seems to me, I argue that it's part of the process of cultural forms, bit by bit, through multiple sites, sort of coming together to show what military masculinity was supposed to look like after World War II. And so one of the ways authorities seemed to do this in this state magazine was to demonize what, you know, was represented as deviant forms of military authority or masculinity as feminized military figures. And so what these cartoons are showing is, you know, General Franco from Spain, the fascist leader of Spain, is shown a lot with, you know, a mustache is sort of general masculine features in his face, but he's wearing a backless red gown and doing like a cha-cha, and various military and presidential leaders in the U.S., in Britain, France, De Gaulle is featured a lot, West German leaders, both in military and civilian positions of power, are represented in this magazine, in these political cartoons, as women or as cross-dressers. And that is juxtaposed with the sort of iconic imagery of Soviet military masculinity, like an officer in a great coat, a hulking sort of figure, or a laborer with his sleeves rolled up, sort of classic socialist iconography. And it's juxtaposed with these images of small, frail looking and or dressed as women folks from rival militaries or civilian governments. And so it's sort of military adjacent, but to me it showed what military masculinity was not supposed to be. It sort of created this other against which the Soviet officer image was juxtaposed. And it's sort of this really powerful imagery, but it's also so strange. And anyone, you know, who's looked at cultural sources in Soviet history, you don't see, or sexuality in Soviet history, you don't see overtly sexualized stuff like this ever. It's notoriously difficult to research this sort of thing in Soviet history. And here in the pages of this very popular, huge distribution magazine are these very sexy images of like very sort of queer sort of just images you don't see in the Soviet press ever. And so I think there's far more to be said about them. And I hope, you know, how I talk about it is just a springboard that I hope other scholars take up and look more, especially in queer histories of how these might be used, because there's a lot there to unpack. But for me, it was sort of this moment of publicly creating, you know, this other, that this feminized other that Soviet military masculinity could not be.
I see. Very interesting. And I wonder if part of the reason is that in general, sex sort of sells, and sex is usually, you know, where things get funny and silly. And this was like, you were not allowed to laugh too much at the Soviet citizens, but at the Westerners, you know, go for it, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, in a sense, like, you know, the overall, one of the overall arguments I make is, you know, of kicking women out of the military, which they were after 1945, demobilized very quickly and not permitted to re-enlist, even when remilitarization was happening for men. And so in a way, the sort of associating foreign militaries with women, with, well, their militaries are probably run by women, to say nothing of sort of the queer imagery of that, was sort of in many ways the worst insult you could at this moment in Soviet history, I would argue, the you know, you could give to a foreign military, that people in dresses are running that military, for Soviet policymakers trying to reassert a Soviet masculinity and masculinized spaces in the military. That was the worst thing you could be. You're wearing a dress and you're in charge of this military. You're a general, no. So it's to me, it was part of this cultural moment and process of reestablishing militarized spaces as men's spaces.
I see. So now, speaking of coding this masculinity, this coding of the Soviet masculinity, I want to ask my final question in regards to this book. But I think you already touched upon that. And the question would be about how astronauts, cosmonauts, and physics, so to speak, this intelligentsia of both military and science, right? How these men were coded as masculine. And again, I think you touched upon Gagarin already. If you have anything to add to that, Erica, I would appreciate that.
Yeah, the last two chapters were probably my favorite. Well, I don't know. I really enjoyed them all, and the cartoons were fun too. But the last two chapters, I talk about nuclear physicists, and yeah, we've touched on Sakharov's narration of the lewd jokes. and the final chapter is on the first six cosmonauts who go up in the early 60s. And so, you know, neither of those sites are explicitly militarized. But my argument in part is that as military sort of adjacent technological spheres, they came into contact and helped enable the processes of remasculinizing military spaces that I talk about throughout the book. So, I mean, the physicists, I have to be careful though, because, you know, I take seriously the pacifism work and activism against nuclear proliferation that Sakharov and many of the others I talk about engaged in later in their lives. And they, you know, wouldn't be happy with me, I'm sure, to be associated with militarism. That was exactly what they were trying not to do. But the spaces of their laboratories in the 50s, it was doing military adjacent work, and they narrate their experiences of that work in their memoirs as a sort of being, you know, put up against military masculinity, like Marshall Nedyelin, who told this joke at the banquet. And so their memoirs narrate these feelings of being subordinate in their masculinity at some points. And then, as I mentioned, you know, at other times, guys like Sakharov are like, we were also godlike and we were above the generals and, you know, walking through the aftermath of a test site like a god, and the power they had to create was superseded military authority. So there's sort of the spectrum of identities that the physicists grapple with. But the cosmonauts sort of finalize it for me. You know, these first cosmonauts are often depicted in sort of Cold War arc of Soviet history as the beginning of, you know, this era of the new Soviet man and this renewed attention to Cold War foreign policy and whatnot. And for me, they were sort of not the beginning of something, but the end result of a process that began in 1948 of reclaiming the military and military spaces for men, and how, you know, a guy like Gagarin and his cohort, which were five men and the first woman in space, Valentina Tereshkova, how they sort of finalized this imagery of you know, appearing on world tours in their Air Force uniforms, as I said, except Tereshkova, who was a civilian and was not allowed to appear in uniform in any way, despite having an honorary rank, and sort of this final vision culturally and in technology of excluding women. Like, she's part of the narrative, but she is limited. And the guys led by Gagarin are this certain look. He has to come from a certain background. He's the face of not only the space program, but sort of a young, vigorous image of Soviet leadership when the actual leadership was much older and not as vigorous seeming, shall we say. And he sort of paraded around the world as this vision of military masculinity. Again, as I said, you have to be careful about that because, of course, no one in the Soviet command structure is saying that the rockets that are going into space could also launch ICBMs at the United States. They're not making the military connections clear, but, you know, insiders do know this. But for domestic audiences, he's just like this good-looking guy. He's a young father. He's, you know, apparently technologically proficient, although historians of the space program have shown he was not allowed to touch the controls of the spaceship. He really is just sort of like a face. And that was true of the first six of them overall. So yeah, they sort of end the story for me. And also he's killed, of course, in a crash in the mid-60s. So my story sort of ends with him as the end result of this process since the 40s of reclaiming these sort of militarized spaces for a certain masculinity in Soviet society and culture.
Interesting. And yesterday, March 9th, was Gagarin's birthday.
That's right.
Yes. And it's interesting that we sort of finish on him because up until nowadays, in the Putin's Russia in the 2000s, early 2000s, in the 2010s and 2020s, Gagarin is still seen by many Russians as this representation of, you know, good masculinity, of gentle masculinity, of what masculinity could look like. Like, he's smiling, he's kind, he's not rough, he's not, you know, he looks like a citizen of the world rather than a typical, you know, Soviet citizen, whatever, with no smile on his face. And I'm just saying that his image is still so important to the understanding of this kind of Russian or Soviet masculinity.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, there's so much more to be said there. And other historians have done it or are doing it on the how his image survived after his death and in post-Soviet Russia. And yeah, he's a really interesting figure to me.
Thank you, Erica. And I already took so much of your time, and I just wanted to wrap up asking my last question about your current projects. Maybe you can share with our listeners, maybe there is a new book or a new research you're working on, and maybe we should expect a new book coming soon.
Yes, for sure. We can always hope, right? yes, no, I do have two quite different projects on the go. One is called Russians on TV, with the Russians part in quotation marks, meaning all kinds of othered Slavic and East European characters. But it's about American and British television shows and films of the past just 15 or 20 years, really. Which, you know, anyone who sort of watched television in this era, you see so many Russian characters or, of course, Ukrainians, Latvians, Chechens, sort of that American and British studios pass off as Russian. And it's not quite the same stereotypes we saw during the Cold War, but they're related. And so it started as sort of a side project just out of interest from watching television in North America these days, but it's turned into more of an academic exploration. And I have a co-edited special issue of the journal Historical Reflections is coming out this summer, 2024, on this topic with a group of 8 really interesting articles. And my second project that I've been on for a long time, some of your listeners might have heard me talk about this before and wonder why is this still in progress, but it's on gender and hockey in Imperial Russian and Soviet history. And I sort of stumbled upon it because it sort of seemed to follow a path similar to the military masculinities in, you know, the book we were just talking about, in that women played hockey or bandy, actually, an ice sport sort of close to it, from the 1890s through to the 30s, not only in Russia and the Soviet Union, but in Ontario and in some other Nordic countries. So I'm looking at that sort of comparatively with some colleagues here in Ottawa who work on hockey history in Canada. Women are sort of kicked out of a new form of the game after the war, and they're not allowed to play what's called Canadian-style hockey, which is the form of the game we know today is sort of the international form of the game. So I want to know what was going on there and how hockey was another site that might have been remasculinized and women are written out of where they had been there before. So how does sort of gender and culture reinforce this space for men? Again, this sort of theme that if I try to get away from it and in history, I keep coming back to over and over again. So I'm still sort of at the beginning stages of that research, but it's quite interesting so far, not least because of the new Professional Women's Hockey League in North America, including here in Ottawa, that I've been really excited about. So lest we think women playing professional hockey is new, it's actually has an older history. And so I want to sort of dig into that.
Very interesting. Thank you so much, Erica. And I'm sure this book and the book on the Russians, you know, in quotation marks, on TV, would be so much of the interest for both Russian-speaking and English-speaking audience. I mean, just all over the world.
I hope so.
Yes, so this was Erica Fraser talking about her book Military Masculinity and Postwar Recovery in the Soviet Union. Erica, I wanted to say thank you for the talk today, and I wanted to say goodbye, but please do not disconnect, okay?
Sure, and thank you so much for having me, Pauline. It was really nice to talk with you and to have this opportunity to talk about my work.